right. Can everyone hear me? Can anyone hear me at all? Okay, there we go. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Augusta McMahon. I'm a member of the BC Council and currently chair of the Publications Committee. Welcome, everyone, to the annual Bonham Carter Lecture. Today is the 31st lecture in this very long-running series of spring lectures for BC. It's a huge pleasure to introduce Mike Laird, our speaker tonight. Mike is a travel writer, explorer, and filmmaker who's been involved in activities as diverse as trekking to the magnetic North Pole, because North Pole just has been done too many times, and assessing things like the potential risks of marine biology conservation projects in Malaysia. Mike is talking to us today about something closer to all of our homes, which is the motifs or the reed structures of the marsh dwellers of South Iraq, and about his future BC-sponsored project to collaborate with a local southern Iraqi community in the marshes to reconstruct a motif. Mike's interested in Iraq and in the marshes derives from his friendship with Wilfred Thesiger, whose explorations in the marshes back in the 1950s should be well known to most BC members. The marshes today are obviously not what they were in the 1950s, but there is hope for the return of the waters, and with the water, the birds, fish, plants, and of course the people of this dynamic and interesting region. So, over to Mike. Talk to us.
Augusta, thank you very much for that lovely introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for coming this evening. You're a challenging audience to me. I can't deny that in terms of your knowledge of the region. I've been very lucky to be out in Iraq several times in the last few years. Well, I say several times, four times in the last few years. It is, of course, an area that you'll all appreciate has accepted voluntarily or not so voluntarily the crossing of great numbers of people from other diverse communities, religions, and country groups. So the Sumerians, the Babylonians, the Persians, more laterally, of course, the Ottomans, the British, and the Americans have come through this. And it's a great area. It's a melting pot of 5,000 years of culture and diversity. And, of course, what we have now is the remnants of the Marsh Arabs, who we all know suffered terribly in 1991, other periods of time as well in their history. And what we're trying to do now is look at what is left, what we can do in terms of culture, what we can do to help them, to salvage what they've got, and what we can do for rekindling what they had and bring them back to being such a special group. So, this is my personal account of my several visits. It's not an academic lecture, right? I've been on a podium many times. My joy is to share. My joy is not to be shot down. So I acknowledge the fact that we have a very mixed audience here, and I look forward to imparting my experiences with you and sharing them as best I can. As Augusta said, Wilfred Thesiger was a great friend of mine who was actually introduced and made available to me by David Burton in the front row, who's a co-director of one of the charities I work for. Wilfred Thesiger, in brief, many of you will know, but for those who don't, and again, this is one of the challenges this evening, is not to teach you to suck eggs for those of you who do know, but to impart enough information to those of you who don't know. Wilfred was born in 1910, the first recorded white man being born in Abyssinia, which of course is now Ethiopia, died in 2003, having lived a great life. He was educated at Eton and Oxford. He went on to work for the SOE, which was the forerunner of the SAS, where he served with distinction. He was invited personally to Haile Selassie's coronation in 1930, and enjoyed countless visits to the marshes and interaction with the Marsh Arabs in the 1950s, so roughly between the period 1950 and 1958. This next book, I read shaking my wind, and unfortunately, I wasn't privileged to meet Gavin Maxwell. He died the year I was born. So from that point of view, either he was unfortunate to die young, or you can think that I'm very young. Thesiger I knew well. I probably met him 10 or 12 times. Gavin Maxwell, as I say, was influential to me in terms of reading his book, one of the three primary accounts, in my opinion, and only my opinion, of the marshes, the latter of which, the third that I read, was, of course, by Rory Stewart, who was a deputy governor in two of the regions, or two of the governance in southeastern Iraq in the early 2000s. Now, I actually bumped into Rory purely by accident Afghanistan, serving with the coalition troops as a photographer in 2007. And this again, these three books and two sort of series of encounters is what gave me the impetus, the desire to go out and see for myself the history that's been left behind and the turmoil that's more recently been caused and what it is that we can enjoy and what we can strive to rekindle with these marvellous, marvellous people going forward. So, looking at the area, some of you will be quite familiar with it. We have the principal towns in the area of Amara to the north, Nasiriyah to the west, and Kurna. Some people would say that this triangle here roughly equates to the marshes. There are other peoples, other tribal groups within the region. You can see that what is or was the former marshlands, there are areas that sit out with the actual deltas or the totality of the area provided water by the Euphrates and the Tigris is very extensive. And again, these are comments that I'm going to go on and talk to you about, disparities in measurement that people suggest that the marshes either were or are. So, the other areas that we're going to be covering today, in brief, we've got Azubayr here, which is very prominent, of course, in Muslim history, and I'll explain why. Al-Faw down here on the mouth of what becomes the Shat al-Arab, and for many people in the room, you will know that term is used after the confluence. So when the Tigris and Euphrates come together in this region, they are known together as the Shat al-Arab. And the last area, of course, is the city of Basra itself. So, getting in, this is just a little docket, this is just a piece of paper, but to people coming in now from the southwest, so from the Kuwaiti side, which is my favourite route to get into the country, things have got a little bit tighter. It's almost ironic, because the tensions are easing, things are becoming a little happier in the region, I appreciate that's an opinion, but to actually now get anywhere close to the border is an incredibly difficult and challenging experience itself. Peter, who just popped in on the first row down here, he was with me on our latest venture out there in October last year, and we weren't totally aware of this required documentation. We travelled from Kuwait City all the way up to the border of Safwan, only to be told you need this, so we had to go all the way back. And these are just the sort of day-to-day challenges. So anyone going to the region, if you've not been totally embraced going, take a little bit of advice from some people perhaps, but also be aware of the requirements. Travelling through this area still comes with its challenges. And in terms of time, don't plan anything by British timekeeping. Plan it by Muslim and local timekeeping styles. So, up to the border, handy old iPhone telling me where I was. The border itself, it reminds us that you need to be flexible. This is just a sort of a furtherment of what I was saying before. It's not easy, but once you get in, it's so worthwhile. This is a normal picture. This isn't as bad as it looks. This is just a regular oil field. But what I want to instill upon people in the audience here is the recent turbulent past. Let's think about what happened in the 1990 invasion of Kuwait, the difficulties when all the oil fields were set alight and the sky was darkened. A very unfortunate, nasty time many of us would just prefer to forget. Moving again on to, rightly or wrongly, I'm not a political speaker here, the 1991 First Gulf War. So, it's just reminding us that this country has suffered terribly, but indeed it always has. It's the crossing point of so many roads in humanity. Nicer things. This was one of my first views of the real marshes. Considered by many to be the Garden of Eden, going back in historical terms, it's referred to as such in many books of varied religions, but also by academics through time. The difficulty we have, and I alluded to this a short while ago, is to actually understand how vast the actual marshes were. I've read figures from 3,000 square kilometres up to 15,000 square kilometres. One way or another, irrespective of what you believe, or any point in the middle, this is a truly vast area, and in ecological and biodiversity terms, hugely important to the world at large. The estimate was that when the marshes were drained, they reduced to 10% of their size. Catastrophic in anybody's imagining. So the Tigris and the Euphrates, two great river systems coming down through Asia, coming down to the confluence of the very south and emptying into the Gulf known as the area known as Mesopotamia, absolutely devastated. This picture I use to try and demonstrate the abundance that the river system used to provide. The Euphrates and the Tigris, and particularly the marshes, provided 60% of fish, which was obviously a major, major source of food and nourishment for the marsh Arabs, but also Iraqis further north as well. Used to provide 60% of the fish, once very plentiful. These particular fish, largely carp and barbel, I gather, but I'm not an angler, became incredibly scarce. And let alone becoming scarce, obviously the reproduction got hit. They were being overfished, so the average size of the fish diminished, etc. So the whole thing was catastrophic. Apart from that, that was just the fish. Everyone in the room probably knows that the ecosystem diminished. The migratory birds went. They didn't return season on season. And when the fish go and the birds go, everything else itself started to suffer, including the plants. The whole ecosystem was utterly shattered. Now, whilst I think we're unified in the room saying Saddam Hussein wasn't the most pleasant of people, understatement of the year, his ability to catastrophically destroy these people was quite incredible. Taking away the water from the marsh Arabs was the be-all and end-all of their existence. This signifies to me how he did it. This is not the primary canal, but you can see this is unusually straight to be a natural waterway in the marshes. He built, or had built for him, what was known as the Victory Canal in the very early 1990s, which is an area of water that's almost incomprehensible in size. 3 kilometres across, 80 kilometres long. This was designed to run off 1,000 square miles of water, and it's still full now. Not forgetting the people in the marshes, those who lost their lives. Again, people in the room, fairly knowledgeable. The majority of people who lost their lives, who suffered, were Shia due to the 1991 uprising. Some of the people came across after the Iraq-Iran war. Some people were Iranians who stayed, who were sympathisers. The marshes shielded large numbers of people from different factions, different guerrilla groups, militia, sometimes inappropriate words, but those are the words that have been used in many documents. And Saddam's ideal was to flush them out. These, thankfully, are mosques in their memory, often, unfortunately, misbuilt on insecure land in the marshes. They've been put up with the best of intentions, with local yellow brick, which is very common in the southeast of Iraq. But you can see by the sort of waterlogged foreground that this building has an unfortunate history ahead of it and is very unlikely to survive as long as one would have hoped. This is something a little happier, but also telling its own story. It's estimated that more than 100,000 people were displaced by the actions in the marshes. Some would say that's a very conservative number. When you look at towns like Amara in the north, that has a population of over 400,000 people on its own. So by the time you take in the other settlements, Nasiriyah, Chibayish, similar places, the actual number of people who could have been depopulated and moved is actually far, far more significant. But again, it's very difficult for the UN or for any other body to actually make an appropriate guesstimate or estimation on this. This, however, shows me a lady standing in the foreground with 3 children around her, cooking bread. The interesting thing is that she's on banked-up earth, which is not natural, of course, in the marshes. This would have been one of the man-made banks on the side of the canals, the channels, which involved huge amounts of earth-moving equipment being brought into the area. And in the back, you can actually see here a JCB, or large earth-moving equipment. And just by my guess, people can challenge this, please feel free. Judging by that doorway, its magnitude and its shape, it looks very much like this is going to be the foundation floor of a mosque. So she's come here. It's a nice secure area for her. But modernity is chasing her all the way. This medium-sized towns in the region called Chubaish. And at the time that the marshes were more fully drained before the partial reflooding, this was just an outlying settlement. You can see, of course, that people have the old-style buildings here, which are built largely out of the cassab reed. And then, of course, in the background, you've got people who are building with breeze block. The unfortunate thing is that the water table has risen significantly, and the people living in these dwellings are going to be suffering, probably, from waterborne diseases, which at the time they built them, when the land was dry, wasn't going to be the case. This itself, this was an area that was dry, now partially reflooded, and we have this typical boat. There are different sizes of boats, and I'll go into to talk about the names for them. Most likely this one's referred to as being a mashuf. They have lesser boats called kites or kayaks, and of course then they go on to the larger boats, particularly the war vessels known as Tiradas. There's a very beautiful and fortunate story I'll be able to share with you that I found on the internet very recently. This I refer to as the car park. This is what it may have looked like. This is what I would like it to look like again. This to me speaks about vibrancy. This tells me that there's a great big community sitting up here, probably just an extended family with their water buffalo, with a plethora of boats. How many are here? You know, there's five or six here. There's another couple over here. This is what the marshes may have looked like in the 50s. This is the closest I've certainly got to it. Unfortunately, this is the partial outcome of what happened. We've got several of these images. Abandoned boats. They're very common across the area. I don't want to focus on them because that's negativity. That's the past. Hopefully we're going to look forward and see what it is that the region may well become again. Some of the area has turned to desert. This, thankfully, judging by its colour, is reasonably well watered. The water table in places is coming up again. Now, the fact that there is water does not mean that it's a sustainable area for crops, for cultivation, for water buffalo and for people, because the residual salinity due to the last 25 years or so of draining is such that many, many crops just cannot survive here. But people are actively working on that. I've been to many laboratories, and I'll be able to show you some pictures of these, where people are looking at specific crops and also towards genetic modification of crops so that they can survive in these areas. This signifies everything to me about the marshes. This, because of its size, it's not a Tirada, it's not high enough on the prow or the stern. But in terms of a mashu for anything similar, this is one of the largest boats we actually found around. It would have belonged to, at the very least, a large extended family or a person who was reasonably well healed. You can see by the fact the bitumen towards the back has melted off in the sun. This has been out of water and dry for a long, long time. It's a very sad thing. But what I'm actually hoping is that some things like this will end up in museums to remind us of how hard these years have been. Again, areas that have been reflooded, I don't need to go into this in any sort of greater detail. These are just sad reminders, a variety of images to show us what has happened in the past and how cruel peoples have been. A dam, no great surprise. One of the biggest problems that we actually have in Iraq at the moment, but the dams aren't necessarily in Iraq, unfortunately, and again, it's a slightly political comment, it's not intended, it's just fact. A lot of the dams are far upstream, particularly on the Euphrates, more so than the Tigris, the biggest of which, of course, is the Ataturk Dam inside Turkey. There are two large dams on the Euphrates upstream from that, two downstream from that. The saddest thing of all is in the news lately, there are 23 more planned. Knowing as well that 90% of the water in this catchment area, or feeding the Euphrates and the Tigris, actually falls outside of Iraq's borders, and only 10% falls within, demonstrates as well the fact that they have reasonably little control over even the water that comes into their river system, let alone how they distribute it and let it free in their own country. People channeling their own water is good locally and catastrophic in terms on a national scale. People do it with the best of intentions. Their aims, of course, are to provide for their own, to provide for their community, to provide for their crops and their livestock. It's counterproductive, of course, to the overall aim of either the government or indeed the country as a whole. It's very difficult for people to manage. It's a vast area of land. This I love. This reminds me, sitting on your mashuv, being pulled through the water, of what everything in the marshes was and can be again. While boar used to exist in plentiful numbers, it's not difficult to go back to Maxwell's books, Thesiger's books, possibly even Rory Stewart's books, and see a picture of a great boar that's been hunted and killed proudly by the local people. Now, thankfully, large numbers of water buffalo are being reintroduced. The farming numbers are becoming greater. But of course, there's only so many that this waterway can sustain. The nicest or fluffiest, perhaps, animals that are returning are the bird life. Things like marbled ducks. To hear that the migratory birds, which live the rest of their year in places like the Great Soot in eastern Africa, or the Camargue in southern France, or in any part of northern Europe, that are coming back to this area is wonderful and great. There are other things which can be done, other things which, when they return, will make it an even greater and more pleasant area to see again. This, to me, I've summed up in my notes as culture, tradition, and practicality. So a young boy who, you know, they're totally different from our communities. We wouldn't normally let a child of 5 or 6 out on a boat on a riverway. That would just seem to us totally incredible. But to these people, the way of life, the way that this child can take a mashuv and go and punt it down the river system to friends, to relatives, to go for shopping, to go for a chore, to help his parents, it's just fabulous to see that these ways are now remaining and that hopefully this child will stay in the marshes for his life. This, I symbolise as tourism. It's nothing to do with me. It's about the opportunity that a wreck has to embrace foreign visitors. It's still difficult. We're not denying that. There are still dangers around it. It's still difficult just to get in. But when you do get in, there are opportunities for foreign investment, opportunities for foreign spend, for people to come in and assist, hopefully in the right way, and hopefully in a parity with the intentions of the government at large. There is no point in charities going into the country and doing things which are contradictory to the intentions of the government. This is one of the roads into Turaish, a lovely sunset, mosque silhouetted on the horizon. This is again to try and tell you and explain to you that these towns have an awful lot to offer the foreign visitor. If I get a show of hands, how many people here have actually been to any of the marshes or the towns? That's great, so we've got maybe 25%. So you'll understand this, it's a wonderful, embracing place to go. I hope that all of you will go back, and I hope that people who haven't been will make the effort to go. Bridges. This, you can see by its construction, is relatively modern. Before the marshes were drained, people went everywhere by boat. There weren't very many bridges. There were, of course, on the outlying large towns, which I've already mentioned, to connect it to other areas. But within the marshes, people would travel by boat and boat alone. Now things have changed. This isn't likely to be reversed. A lot of the change isn't reversible. Some of it is. But this is just an indication that things have moved, we might say, forward. But is it necessarily forward for the best reasons? Difficult to say. And again, whilst they've moved, you can see that some roads are tarmacked, others are not tarmacked. The seasons here are very variable. At the moment, I think by checking the temperature in Basra today, was around about 48 degrees. So quite muggy, quite hot for a lot of us. Certainly not a temperature you're going to want to go out and do some work for an NGO or a charity. And even the local people keep saying to me, Mike, please don't bring your people here when it's too hot, because it really is just difficult for everybody. But again, you can see at this time of year, this was taken in October last year, the road's quite wet. So even though we're not on the rivers, there are still challenges moving. The locals manage it very well, but they're a hardy bunch. For us to go out there on mopeds and regular vehicles would be a little bit difficult. But again, you don't want to attract the unnecessary attention. It's not, in my opinion, necessary to go out in large armoured vehicles with armed soldiers. You know, I think we're beyond that now. The people are embracing. There are some difficulties, but with the right connections and a little bit of common sense, moving through a rank is a joyous experience. I've got 4 pictures here, coming of rubbish. century. Four images now, and then I'm going to read you something. So just look at these and ponder them, please. This is just a waterway in a village. This is good and it's bad. We've got along the side outflow pipes of untreated sewerage going into what was once a beautiful waterway. This is on the outskirts of Basra, so this isn't what some people would consider the real marshes. This is really the sort of periphery of the city. However, purely by chance, and I have to confess, even as a photographer, I didn't spot it until I studied the picture. We have a pied kingfisher sitting on a pole, just really as a symbol saying, okay, so you're throwing all this junk and rubbish at me, but I'm still here. And again, you know, the more unfortunate than you can probably imagine, the volume of rubbish, the ability to recycle, the knowledge about pollution and the opportunities for recycling haven't been there until I read this. This was in a BBC report dated the 1st of June this year, so just a couple of weeks back. Drained to less than 10% of their former size under Saddam's regime, these vast marshes are coming to life again. Through the actions of environmentally conscious and brave Arabs, the huge embankments have been breached, allowing the water to flow back. Now at least half have been successfully reflooded. The wildlife and marsh Arabs have returned. Overhead, a pied kingfisher hovers, searching for fish. In the reeds, I can hear the song of the endangered Basra reed warbler. While on the water, a group of birds take off, four globally threatened marbled ducks. Along the banks of the Euphrates, that together with the Tigris is the lifeblood of the marshes, throngs are gathering. The festival is underway. First in the motif, there is a reading from the Quran, followed by the Iraq national anthem. Then some of the speeches, music by children, and poems are read. On the river, the first boat race ever held in the marshes is underway. Six mashoofs, each with a single woman rower, wearing a black abaya, battle for first place. There were loud cheers from the crowd, which was more than 1,000 strong, as the winner crossed the line. So, it would seem that there is an awful lot of vibrancy. It would seem that there is a new awareness. They are driving great big projects to clean up this misfortune of rubbish. It's a complete eyesore. But are we any better in Europe? It's a question for you to ponder. So, move on now to reeds and reed cutting. One of the great sort of strong points, one of the great traditions within the marshes. Possibly their lifeblood. The particular reed that these people cut is known in scientific terms as Phragmites, very common in Australasia, Europe. Out there it's known as cassab or birdie. Cassab is the longer, stronger of the two, used very widely in building and for other purposes, and we'll go on to have a look at that in a minute. These two guys, reed cutters, no great surprise, they're sitting down there taking a break, very obliging to let me take the photograph. They work all their lives cutting reeds. They've done this for 5,000 years since the Sumerians were there. The Sumerians were the people who, it's guessed, we obviously have little records, so it's supposition, hopefully an educated one, that they were the people who started building structures such as the motif, which we're going to go on and look at shortly. These people, it's a lifelong tradition. So they're cutting these reeds all day, 4 to 5 metres high. They don't often grow that high in other cultures. So it's a very nice environment when the water's available. It's a very good environment for these particular reeds, the mixture of the nutrients, the mud, the sunshine and the water. So it's a great place, and that's why they've become so prolific. This is quite an interesting picture for a couple of reasons. First of all, this guy's on the mashu. No great surprise, you see plenty of them. This was the first aluminium one I'd ever seen. Plenty of wooden ones around. This again, the change to modernity. There is actually a reason as well why it's aluminium, is because the wood supplies now, with the diminishing number of palm trees, means that it's a lot harder to find wood for building the boats in this particular region. And again, I'll go on and give you some facts and numbers to cheer about the diminishment of the lovely palms and day palms, etc. later. The other thing I find quite staggering about this gentleman is that he's poling or punting his boat through the reeds, and yet he's got an outboard motor on the back. Really didn't understand why he paid for that, but that's his personal choice. So, bringing it in, as I call it, they bundle the reeds like this easiest way, of course, they go out often chest deep in water to go and cut the reeds, bring them in. They serve multiple purposes. Animal feed, the white shoots on the end, very nutritious for the water buffalo. And of course, we know that they dry the longer of the reeds to actually construct the superstructure, the major columns in the motif. And they use the leaves, etc., to make a mats which form the outer shell and also for flooring. So this again tells me, you know, we're looking at this with this gentleman. He's got petrol up here, but he's got no outboard. That was also a bit of a surprise. Couldn't work that one out. Here he's got an outboard and he's got petrol, so this guy seems a little bit better off. All a bit of an anathema to me, but there we are. Two young guys bringing it in. This looks like happy days, doesn't it? They've been out working hard. They're bringing this stuff in. They're going to go take it to market. They're going to earn their daily crust, make some money, take some food out to their families. Everyone would seem to be happy. But bear in mind that the marshes is only partly reflooded. The levels of farming may not be sustainable. The people at this point in time aren't all thinking about sustainability, and the education may not be there for them. And what I'm partly trying to share with you, or in part, is to say to you all, what can we do as a group to give them the leg up in terms of cultural preservation? And surely part of their culture must be around the reeds, the motif, the water buffalo, and everything that's linked to it. If this chain breaks down, cultural preservation in this region is not going to be possible. So, I see this as old meeting new. In days gone by, these boats would come in, and it would all be loaded onto horse or buffalo-drawn carts. Now, of course, faster ways to get it to market, faster ways to make money. So again, the turnover is quicker, and they're harvesting more. Again, this has an impact on the sustainability of cassava and burley reeds as a crop in the region. Quite a joyous picture, I think. It doesn't need any more explaining. This human power can come about, of course, for several reasons. Largely, it's down to the fact that an awful lot of the ladies in this region are widowed. Because an awful lot of men went off to war, a lot of them didn't come back. So, you see this a lot. It's an unfortunate consequence. We just pray that it'll get better. Motif. So, we've all seen plenty of pictures. You've read about it in books. You've seen glorious black and whites. Now you get to see some in colour. There are quite a few people who've been to the region will appreciate that. There are quite a few. There used to be a lot more. My hope is that we can help the people build more. Very kindly, the British Institute for the Study of Iraq gave a grant to the charity I work for, along with my co-directors, Gary and David, on the front row here. And we went out with a group in October last year. And unfortunately, largely due to one of our primary fixers having typhoid, we were unable to conclude that project and ended up doing work on some local schools. However, Augusta and I have talked at length, and we're looking forward to concluding these projects in the future. This was the first motif that I saw and was lucky enough to go in. I think the next picture is quite spectacular, so I'm going to hold on to you for a minute and tantalise you with it. But I want to show you a couple of things about this motif. Motifs, it's argued, last, give or take, 20 years. This is because they're built into what is fairly wet ground. You can see a puddle here. The ground here is absolutely saturated. They're built out of cassava reeds, straw, effectively, tough straw at that. They rot. They do everything they can in their structure to prevent that. And traditionally, the posts, these large bundles which form the superstructure and columns over the top here, they're coated in bitumen, sometimes now in polythene. But of course, water still permeates, comes down, you know, a rainy day, it'll come down here and run in, and then it gets trapped in the polythene or bitumen, and then rots, and it's almost counterproductive, so it's very difficult. So, to actually see how they're built so that they can go on and go back to their communities and help them build more often. The next picture is possibly my favourite picture of the whole slideshow. The inside of a motif. Now again, you often get the grander pictures, I didn't get the opportunity, with perhaps a row of village elders, or a days gone by, they would tell you it would be a war council, sitting down the side in their beautiful robes, cross-legged, drinking coffee. We had a nice evening in this, but several people asked me not to take pictures. They were a little bit more reserved. You can see, of course, at the end, typically there'd be some pictures, usually of a prominent man from history, usually a martyr. Lovely cushions for sitting on, the fine carpet. In the foreground, actually, sort of here on the sort of black skirt of the screen, there would be a hearth with the coffee pots, which would be fired up in the evening for everyone to enjoy a nice hot coffee together. This was a gentleman whose motif it was, who entertained me for the afternoon, a very nice gentleman, and introduced me to his son as his greater community. Peter and I were lucky to be entertained in a motif on our last visit, to have to drinks with the local community, a fairy grand shake, and we were discussing the opportunities for building out. What I want to show you here is the idiot grinning in the foreground. It's the girth of these actual columns. Now, they taper quite naturally as they go towards the top, because not all of the reeds will be as tall as each other. So some of them are 3 metres tall, some four, some five, etc. And they just span over and they go across the roof. And they build them as two uprights and then tie them off at the top and tidy them up. Huge amount of work, but unbelievably, these are reasonably quick buildings to put up. We were told with an appropriate workforce that these could be built, as long as the supplies kept coming in about 14 days from start to finish. This gives you a little idea about the intricacies, the way that the reeds are twisted, woven together, almost like string. And I've got a picture slightly later on where it's even more evident that they still retain great strength, even though they can be shredded down to almost to their individual fibres, then woven back together, just like a ball of string. I'll just let you look at that one and think about it. This, of course, you need light. You need daylight. The windows are designed to give ventilation, of course, in summer, not to be too cold in winter, to optimise the amount of daylight that comes through, but also they don't want to have any sandstorm coming through on a windy day. So it's a bit of a trick. And the way that they're put together, the way that these individual sheets are constructed, you do get the superstructure built first, so the great big columns. Then the sides are built largely in this lattice style. And then the roof traditionally would be matting, which would provide a waterproof or as waterproof as possible covering. They're incredibly robust buildings, and very beautiful, quite unique. This is an alternative style. They obviously rethought building directly onto the ground when they built this, and you can see that the earth is being considerably banked up. This motif on the outside looks very, very traditional. We're going to go inside it in a minute, and there's a very significant change to this, apart from the fact it's on an elevated bank. Designed, of course, to prevent it rotting so that it will last longer. On the inside here, this was a day that Peter was present and we were enjoying the company of many local gentlemen. You can see, if you look closely here, there is an almost table-like structure between some of the columns. This is actually concrete. So this one, the posts were set direct into concrete to preserve them as best as possible to give it this longer-lasting sort of permanency. And what we didn't see, of course, in the previous one, which we can see here, is the very grand brass coffee pot sitting on the hearth. Very, very traditional. This makes me giggle for a reason that might not be immediately apparent to everybody. My guess is that the gentleman who built this downsized it from a full-size motif and downsized every single specification on this, and totally forgot that the door should still be tall enough for a man to walk through. This door is under 5 foot tall. And I think it's more evident on the next picture is that apart from the fact there's a little lip here. So motifs don't have to conform to any particular size. But one thing that some people in the audience might be able to tell me about is why every single motif I've ever seen and been in has an odd number of columns. So maybe if someone afterwards could share that piece of information, that would be great for me in terms of sharing education. The other thing that I think has piqued notice more so than myself was when we were in the region, was they're starting now to build an awful lot of what you might call faux relief. There is a metal superstructure put in place. They are built of breeze blocks, but they are still totally sympathetic to the shape, style, and purpose. And indeed, talking about the purpose, we encountered all sorts of debate on what the purpose of a motif might be. Some people, of course, would tell us it was akin to a village hall. Some people would say it was an opportunity or a meeting place for elders or indeed a war council. Some people said that on occasion it could be used as a madrasa or a school. Some people told us it was an almshouse. We choose to embrace all of those as notions of what a motif might be. And if anybody would like to come and discuss that with me further, I would love to know your opinions, because they are truly unique buildings. Even in Iraq, they don't exist the whole country wide. They are very specialist to this area. This is what I was talking about, the sort of string. People have actually been able to knot these. If you go home and try and get two reeds and try and tie them together, believe me, they will splinter into dust and they will just fall apart. I don't know quite what the skill is, how the people do it, but it's utterly fantastic. This also was to demonstrate the fact that the roof, very different to the site where ventilation is allowed and, of course, daylight, the roof is designed to cope with occasional rain, obviously to keep the people inside totally dry. This is just style. What I wanted to say here was that a motif builder in Iraq might well be considered akin to a thatcher in Great Britain. If you're looking for a thatcher in Glasgow, you're going to be stuffed. You're not going to find one for love nor money. Likewise, if you're in Kurdistan and you're looking for a motif builder in Iraq, they're not going to be very easy to find. So it's very much down to style, it's down to region. People imparted on us the fact that motifs have individual styles even within the region, particularly to their builders. And likewise, there may be individual markings put in them or symbols, as indeed a thatcher might put a bird on top of a thatched house. This one I put in for the reason that we have electricity cables coming in on all different sites. Electric light. Now, I think everyone will agree that Iraqi electricians aren't perhaps totally safety conscious, and there is still the opportunity for the odd spark or two to catch fire on these beautiful buildings. However, compared to the alternative of lanterns and canterns, candles and lanterns in days gone by, it's obviously a lot safer, and I'm quite sure that many a motif met its demise to a candle. These are, to the best of my knowledge, awnings or sort of curtains which can be let down to give additional warmth. They seem to me like the bells and whistles. I think every motif should have them because it makes them far more inhabitable and far more comfortable in winter. But we didn't see them on every single one. So again, it speaks to me that there are styles, there are differences, and it's nice if we're going to go and preserve these. We should be looking to see what we can do, not just to build one, but to share all of the peculiarities and all of the specialisms that a motif can attract. I would like, with the assistance of people in this room, to understand more fully all that a motif can be, all that it was, and to actually collate, perhaps for and on behalf of BISI, an actual compendium of photographs of motif, what they have been in days gone by, what we have today, and look at capturing all of the styles and all of the add-ons, if I can be so brusque as to put it that way. So we were kindly given this grant. We had to go out and do something with it. We didn't conclude our project, but we did manage to get a long way with it. On the left, particularly, you can see two colleagues of mine who are dressed very differently to the local gentleman. So the Marsh Arabs still adopt the more traditional rather than the sort of city attire. Abu Akram here, my friend Dr. Sami Bilal, who is a London resident Iraqi, have facilitated an awful lot to do with these projects, taken us out there, embraced our willingness to help them and to smooth our path, but also to make sure that what we're doing is in tune with what Iraqis actually want. This is us going out and doing a site ranking. Now, when we first saw it, we were rather perplexed, thinking, you know, this is the piece of land we've been given. There's quite a few humps and bumps in this going across. It's certainly going to be a challenging piece of land. One of the first things we're going to have to do is go and hire a JCB, get it up country. This is an area known as Hawer, and spelled H-A-W-R for people. It's a very embracing area. The local community here are displaced from far further north. They're actually from north of Baghdad. They are a very welcomed but very poor Shia group, and they've settled in the region for more than 12 years. They don't have a Modif. This is part of the reason we would like to give them one. They have said their intention would be to use it both as a madrasa and as a meeting place, and we thought this was very embracing. So we felt theirs was a very worthy cause, and we're very glad to be working with them, and of course in conjunction with British Institute for the Study of Iraq. This is their community, fairly simple, very rural, a mixture of traditional buildings and some breeze block built buildings. Hard to totally tell you what the local population is. We've been told the greater family is in the region of 200 people. But again, census isn't widely done. It's all word of mouth and talking and embracing people with campus cups of tea. So this is a very traditional local house. And one of the things that always staggered me, made me smile, was the fact that electricity coming in here, their prized possession, a satellite dish and a television, to be in touch with the outside world. And it's actually more important than you might think. We're going to go on, and I think soon we're going to get a picture of the children. I was hoping that was coming up next because I've not been looking at the notes. One of the most important things from my point of view about helping this community isn't just about giving something to them, but it's about making sure that this rural community is actually on a par with children in Basra, Baghdad. The country is developing at quite a pace, but to leave communities behind the cities will just make that gap grow wider and wider. To give them the opportunity of a place for learning will keep them closer and on a par with the cities. They'll never be as far advanced, but at least they won't be forgotten and left behind. So, typical room. A lot of the bedding maintained up here. The room totally changes at bedtime. This was another room in the community. Very nice, very comfortable. This is where guests are entertained. They're actually, you know, they've got ceiling fans, lovely carpets. The food is great. If you get the chance to go to Iraq and you've not been, you're missing something. Please go. Don't forget, though, that we are in the marshes. That house was in a very dry area, so they still have to locate a pump in an area of wetland to get the water to their homes. The water is varying in quality. Sanitation, again, and education is not as widely understood as it might be where we live. The people, however, are incredibly resilient. I can't say the same for myself, having come back several times and being a little bit under par. Lady very proud of the day's catch. Again, these are not barbel and perch that they would find in the bigger areas and wider areas of the Euphrates and the Tigris. But nevertheless, the rivers are still producing large numbers of fish. Sustainability, very important for these people. They used to hunt with spears, trident spears on boats. Now, however, they're fishing with nets. The population, again, is increasing. They're taking more fish out of the water. What we should be trying to do is to encourage them and share with them notions of sustainability so that their future can be secured. This was when I was having lunch one day in this lovely family home. Of course, you can see out of focus in the background the lady who was just showing me the fish and the young boy. They maintain the animals in the properties, particularly the young ones. So this is a very loving water buffalo coming to say hello to the camera. And it's not that long ago that we did this in Britain. It's actually very sensible, particularly in winter, where you keep the animals inside a property for warmth. And of course, in summer, they actually keep them under the shade to prevent them themselves from dehydrating, temperatures out here can easily exceed 50, something to 55 degrees in the middle of summer. So quite tricky for the animals. These are the, I call this anger management. You don't want these boys sitting in your living room. You know, these are a bit too big, and particularly this fellow with the hairdo. He was, they like, as we do, to mark their animals, usually with henna or some type of dye in the hair so that it can be identified if they wander into another community. This chap I thought was very affable, and he nearly trampled me. So I took one picture and then backed off. We're getting slowly but surely towards the end. We've got about another 12, 15 slides to go. This is one of the less pleasant and more sad aspects of my talk, which is down towards the region of Al-Fal, where the Shatt al-Arab comes down and goes into the Gulf itself. The salinity here, of course, being in proximity to the Gulf, still tidal, so the tide still comes in, but we're not getting the water, the fresh water from the river system, pushing out to desalinate. The date palms are dying in great number. Now again, getting exact numbers is difficult. I've read that there were between 18 and 32 million date palms in this region. These dates, within the Arabic and the greater world, were regarded as some of the tastiest and best dates, and this was the second biggest economic income for Iraq after oil. There were between 500 and 600 different types, and by that I'll interpret that to mean species of dates. Now they've managed to resurrect possibly 320. The date palms that they're putting back in are still struggling because, of course, the water's not been flushing through the soil. We discussed earlier the fact that we've got the Ataturk, two dams higher, two dams lower. Tragically, more dams planned. This could mean the end. However, we're going to go on and see that there are people working very hard to actually overcome this, even if the water is not available. But it's going to be quite a struggle. This was a henna farm. This is just designed to show you that it's not just the dates that are suffering. All the opportunities in southern Iraq for agriculture, whether it's arable agriculture, larger crops like date palms, or the rearing of animals, is really, really suffering. It's quite tragic. Even in the distance where we've got these stumps, you can see that the heads have fallen off these beautiful date palms. These ones here are just withering. They're just waiting to die. And the ground, tragically, is nearly toxic. The salinity levels are such that nothing will grow here. This, again, one of the former waterways, dwindled to a mere trickle. These holes here, all over riddling this, support one of the few species which can actually live here, which is a mudskipper. They're common, they're growing in great number. They're actually a hugely interesting species to certain people who are interested in amphibians, because some people say it's the sort of breach between water-based and land-based animals coming out. So their vertebrates, they got flippers, which they're effectively using as legs. And some people say it's the breach between these two types of distinct animals. This I find particularly sad. One duck and his two girlfriends struggling around looking for some water. Hopefully one day it'll return. This again is the human consequence, where in the marshes we saw a water pump amongst healthy green reeds sucking in reasonably clean water that is quite potable. This is the complete antithesis. And people down in Al-Fal who don't have the ability to move are condemned to drinking this type of water, which is tragic. Again, the boatyards down in Al-Fal, which used to build these magnificent wooden dhows, which were seen all the way up the Shatt al-Arab, the Euphrates, the Tigris, and the seas beyond, now they're just left decaying. And here, all we have is the actual skeleton of one, the skeleton of another, and what was then to be its superseding iron kind of structure has just been left there, possibly for 20 years. The opportunity for these to be resurrected is not beyond possibility, but it's going to take a miracle. This, again, salt deposits cropping up in the soil. Anyone who knows about ground salinity, to actually see that amount of salt in that concentration coming through soil is horrific. And again, another horror from days gone by, down towards the south, without wishing to dwell on nasty times. These are the bunkers from the military presence down in the south, protecting the Gulf for Saddam's regime, thankfully now a thing of the past. These guys are a cheery hope for the future. Several of them we met when we were out there. Needless to say, I've met them all, but on the last visit, chap to the left here, the big grinning smile, Abu Zainab, a very nice guy who helped us immeasurably with many projects and initiatives, and two friends of his who are scientists, and they are now trying to genetically modify date palms as seedlings to be more resistant. Now, date palms are already incredibly resistant to salinity, but at the moment they're being beaten back. So what they're trying to do in these laboratories, which is taking huge amounts of input from the government as well, the Iraqi government and foreign aid, the United Nations, etc., is to try and overcome the problems and to develop types of date palms which are going to be resistant and will withstand the period of time between now and hopefully when fresh water will once again cleanse this land. Now, I've got another piece of reading, just briefly, which is called The Rebirth of the Mesopotamian Marshes, which came out in National Geographic on the 1st of May, so again, not very long ago. And it's to do with the fact that a Goldman Prize, which is an environmental prize, was awarded to an Iraqi gentleman for his work in marshes. And it says, displaying deep humility, Hassan Awash accepted a Goldman Prize on behalf of his team, Nature Iraq, a group he founded in 2004. Going further, he added, it is the marsh Arabs who showed what is possible in a free Iraq. Awash said, with the patience and a sense of humour, my team worked under incredibly difficult circumstances to achieve what some experts said was impossible. Awash grew up fishing in the Mesopotamian marshlands in southern Iraq, which scholars believe is the cradle of the earliest civilizations. The lush habitat was also the cradle of diverse wildlife, from water buffalo to lions, otters, foxes, and a plethora of birds and fish. But in the mid-1990s, Saddam Hussein burned and drained much of the area to drive out the Shiite Arabs. The marshes, however, turned to a dust bowl, and the people who lived there for thousands of years, descendants of the Sumerians, began to suffer. Like many Iraqis, Awash fled the country in their struggled years, and he settled in Los Angeles. There he became a successful engineer, and in the 2000s he began returning to his homeland for extended periods with the goal of using his technical skills to bring back water to the region. Working with the local marsh Arabs, Awash and his team helped to reflood the area. The reeds returned, reflooded by much of the wildlife. About half of the original marshlands are now flourishing, and the area is slated to become Iraq's first national park. So, there is light at the end of the tunnel. There is positivity. The last area that I chose to go and consider the options for cultural sustainability and assistance was down towards Azubair in the far southwest of the country, not very far from the Kuwaiti border. The great mosque at Azubair was, and I hope I get this right for Muslim speakers in the or Arabic speakers in the audience, was named after Zubair Al-Awwam, Ibn Al-Awwam, who was one of the Prophet Muhammad's closest followers. This great mosque was built, and is particularly important because it is the oldest Muslim structure outside of Saudi. It's the oldest Muslim structure outside of Saudi Arabia. And on the right-hand side, what you can see is the remains of the original minaret, which tragically they believe that the rest of the mosque was demolished during an earthquake. And of course, they've rebuilt its modern counterpart next door. So a great place of pilgrimage, a great place of religious interest, slightly challenging for non-Muslim people to visit because it's so revered and so important, but nevertheless worthwhile, and you can get there. This is the other side of the remaining minaret. So again, you have to understand that this was built before 700 AD, within 60 years of Prophet Muhammad's death. So it is a place of huge cultural significance and needs to be preserved. That's it in more detail, close up, and again I'll zoom in one more time. That's the very intricate brickwork in a very traditional style, up to towards its top, so you can only imagine how magnificent this must have looked in its heyday. We only have two pictures left. They're not meant to be unpleasant. They are a graveyard. The reason that we've taken these pictures and brought them into you today is that Azubayr as a town was, many believe, the founding place of modern-day Basra. This was the original city, and possibly one of the first places of Muslim settlement outside of Saudi Arabia. So it's hugely important. Little known about, little excavated, with help, with money. It's a place that is going to necessitate assistance. I'm asking you to think about that. This is the last slide. It's a grave to symbolise the past. What I'm hoping is that thinking about this, think about the future. Before I take questions, please, Augusta, if I may, I would just like to thank several people here and several people not here. So in no particular order, if I may first of all thank the British Institute for the Study of Iraq for their kind grant to our project. Secondly, if I may, to people in the room, I would like to thank Joe McKeever, Dr. Augusta McMahon, and Lauren Mulvey. In absentia, if I may, I would like to thank our Iraqi friends, Dr. Sami Bilal, Abbas al-Nahi, and the Governor of Basra. I would also like to thank, and I don't often get the chance, my co-directors Gary Tong and David Burton, and finally, the people who accompanied me on the last trip, Peter Kola, and in absentia, Ben Sansbury and Nick Jones. Please, questions. Fabulous, I'm just going to get a sip.
About 3 years ago, a British company, I'm not sure whether I can name it here or not, but it'd be well known to you, designed a school that looked like a mudhif from the outside.
Yes.
And I wondered whether you saw that as possibly the way forward. It reduces, obviously, the amount of reeds that go into a mudhif because it's just a facade, really, while retaining the character of the original.
But to assure you, I know who you're talking about. The initials of your building firm are MM. Yes, we're very well aware. I'm a person who's interested in cultural preservation. Culture to me is wider than the building materials used. And as we ourselves discovered, there are buildings out there which have a superstructure of metal, which of course is never used in the traditional relief style, but still give, and possibly give a more lasting semblance and aspect for cultural preservation. So I have to say that I'm wholly in favour. If environmentally they can be built out of reeds, and if the bringing together of modern and old can facilitate somehow, like the concrete foundation, but with the reed superstructure on top, I think that might possibly give the best outcome. But I actually think that in terms of cultural preservation, it's important that the reeds are still used, because otherwise the skill set for building in such a manner will be lost in one or two generations' time. So I think it's a balance. I think people have to find a way, but I think what you're talking about is totally, totally important.
Sorry, just a rather ordinary question. How much does it cost to build the average size mudhif?
When we were last there,
no problem.
When we were last there, we were quoted a price of $3,000 for the materials. There is still the issue of land purchase or land rent, and there is still the issue of labour. In the community that we were discussing it with, they were willing to provide the labour force for free. And they told us that there would be no charge to build it on the land. So whilst I'm giving a figure of $3,000, I'm just saying there are other considerations that you may need to bring into play if you or a group of colleagues or associates were considering doing it yourself. And of course, the prices are very, very flexible. We negotiated hard, and it will depend upon the availability of reeds in any region you're in, how many wood heaves there are, how far they have to bring in the master craftsman. The labour force is generally going to be available, but a person with a particular skill set might not be. And the further he has to come in, the more he's going to cost you. It'll take about 14 days with a good labour force. Yes, yes. They can put the arches up in 2 or 3 days. And you see, the mats are already bought. It's like if you're going to put up a garden fence, you don't start with a pile of wood generally. You'll go and buy 6 foot by 6 foot panels, put in posts, and then the panel goes in between. So it actually seems quite a fast building process. And likewise with these, the mats will already be constructed for the roof. And it's a case of building the superstructure, putting on the walls, putting on the roof, and then putting on the front and end. No, a wood heaf traditionally would only be built by a sheikh, either a local or a regional. Again, they've got different amounts of money available to them depending upon the number of people they look after and the type of farming and farmland that they have. Some communities cannot afford to build a wood heaf. Tragic.
If we look at the motif and we count the number of arches, they are odd numbers.
Yes.
Why? I got the book, the Kevin Maxwell. He didn't find an answer for it.
I don't know if it's true, but I actually like that answer a lot. It makes a lot of sense.
Because,
you know, it's very important. You'll appreciate there's an awful lot of people here, possibly from Iraq, and understanding the sensibilities in terms of treating people equally and rank and hierarchy, to actually have people seated in an appropriate manner, not to cause embarrassment or offence. I can see an awful lot of sense in the answer that Peter got from the community that we were with.
Well, I lived...
Would you like to repeat that, Peter?
Yes.
For...
yes.
Sorry, thank you. Yeah. We, from discussing with the community and asking in the actual Medif that we were in, they were saying that the reason there is an odd number of pillars is that you can the sheikh or the important person within the building can sit in the middle and have an equal number of people either side. So you know, in terms of respect and that's.
Subhi al-Hazawi, may I give you another problem?
Please, sir.
In my 40 year of research on the indigenous courtyard houses of Baghdad and the rest of Iraq, the bay windows, known as shanashil, they usually incorporate an odd number of bays.
Okay.
Yeah. And I believe the reason for that is, I mean the bay, not the columns. And the reason for that is aesthetics. And therefore, you would look at the space between two columns rather than in the column. In exactly the same way I'm looking at you, my eyes would be concentrating on your nose, whether it's this side, that side, or whatever. While if you look at the eyes, it's a lot easier to draw from the eyes upwards and to the sides. That is a question I was asked in 72 by my late friend, the architect, Henry Svoboda, and he was really puzzled by it, and I have come to this conclusion on my own. However, there are bay windows in Baghdad, which are of even number, and I can't explain that, perhaps because of the plot. But may I ask only Modif, if I may? I hope I'm not taking too much time. If you are, what I would like you to tell the people and you to understand is the fact that it is the environmental aspects of this relief which are the highest after the structural problems, or the fact that I can actually do this with reeds, with qasab. And that is because the humidity there is about 95% most of the time. And therefore, what you need is a continuous flow of air through the relief, through your body, and that is the best way to give you comfort, because the air would actually evaporate the humidity next to your skin. And this is why we wear the dishdasha, you know, the robe itself, because the air circulates quite easily. Unfortunately, in this country, as soon as the sun is out, people strip. But in fact, and this is the wrong idea, because if you want to really keep your self comfortable, you should keep a bit of clothes on you. And this is why even in the desert, you know, the Bedouins actually wear these. Yeah. But the thing you have to concentrate on here also in technical matters, how are you going to keep the reeds intact away from termites and away from getting rotten? And that is building science. Indeed. And we have to investigate. Building science. Yeah. Building technology science, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Building materials, yes.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I would like to ask just... Yeah, can I...
The rest of you can catch me afterwards. I'll be hanging around.
Yeah, okay. Can I ask a question about how often reeds are harvested during the year and which is the best month? If you remember, you know, this Scandinavian man who built a boat said August is the best season for the reeds, and he built a boat to go around the world, and he got to Somalia, and then there was a war, and he couldn't continue. And he had old people from all over the world, including Palestinians and Israelis, on the boat.
Okay. In brief, I honestly don't know. From what I do know, cassab seems to be harvested year-round, but there are probably good times and bad times. We do know that if we were going to get a specific amount of cassab cut for our own purposes, it would need to be dried in the sun before being used. The period of drying we've been given is roughly 6 to 8 weeks. In terms of how well it grows and its best time for harvest, I honestly don't know. Sorry. Yes,
yeah.
Please.
One thing is that you were hoping that the heritage would continue. Hopefully. The trouble is now among the Iraqis, especially the marsh Arabs, who have become quite wealthy and have moved into towns, they are building their own mudhif next to their homes. I've seen two mudhifs, one in Baghdad and one in Nasiriyah, and they are out of this world, much bigger than the one you showed.
Will you take me when you next go?
But
take me with you when you next go.
Next time. In Baghdad, definitely, I'll take you to.
Thank you.
And so so it's a new function for the mudhif is going. And the other one for Leila to say is the smaller marsh, you know, the smaller dwellings in the marshes. We were there in the spring, and a mini mudhif was just built, because they just moved in, this family of four. They just moved in. So they built it in the spring, let's say. Secondly, when I asked, how long did it take you to do this? Thinking that it will take a month or so. He said 2 days.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
Fabulous. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all very much indeed.
Well, I think I'm supposed to
formally propose a vote of thanks. You almost done it for me. Mike, I just wanted to say a huge thank you. Your passion, your enthusiasm for the subject came across very clearly. It sparked a lot of interest. I hope you can stay longer so you can answer some of the additional questions that clearly are. I found it fascinating. Having grown up in Baghdad in the 50s, Wilfred Thesinger was one of my early heroes. I never met him. You're lucky. I think I saw him once, sort of ghostly figure in the Travellers Club, but never got further than that. But we wish you all success with this project, helping restore one of Iraq's communities and put right one of the many catastrophes that Saddam Hussein visited on this country. It's clearly a very worthy cause. We hope you'll come back again and tell us when the project is more advanced. Meanwhile, thanks again for those of you who can stay. I hope you'll join us for a drink, a small reception here, chance to talk further to Mike and to his colleagues. And if anyone here who's new wants to find out more about BISI and hasn't already been collared by Lauren, then you won't escape. But please talk to any member of the council here or to Lauren about BC and come back and see us again. And a final round of applause for Mike. Thank you very much.